Our media is not free. It's not fair. It suppresses thought. It suppresses speech. And it's become the enemy of the people. It's become the enemy of the people. It's the biggest problem we have in this country. Donald Trump, January 6th, 2021. Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast. Today, we will be talking about the importance of the freedom of the press in a democracy. Fake news, enemy of the people, failing, the opposition party, scum. All of those terms are the most common ways that Trump describes the media, whether it is in political speeches or Truth Social posts. According to some ChatGPT analysis, in the first 19 months of Trump's first presidency, from January 2017 to August 2018, Trump tweeted the terms fake news or fake news media 291 times. And this is according to a white paper conducted by Michael Cornfield at the GWU Graduate School of Political Management on April 10th, 2019. Since then, it can be extrapolated that he has used that term to denigrate the media thousands of times since 2015. Most of us living in 2025 associate Trump with that term, but in fact, the exact term fake news was first used in 1894 by the Kansas City Times to describe its rival papers. And during this time, yellow journalism was much more common due to very intense newspaper wars between Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst. And it was a threat, of course, to the legitimate media. Yellow journalism was a sensationalist and exaggerated style of newspaper reporting that was basically like the clickbait of the time. Eye-catching headlines, scandal, and drama were the most common themes in newspapers during a time where competition between newspapers was really fierce. During the 2015-2016 U.S. presidential campaign, the term fake news surged because yellow journalism was back. The city of Veles in North Macedonia became most famous for its content farms, and these were websites run by teenagers and young adults that made up sensationalized stories as clickbait. The whole incentive was just to make money through online advertising, because the more someone clicks on a link, the more they get paid. I mean, it's kind of similar these days, but, you know, I think people are a little bit more savvy about clickbait for the most part. So they were just trying to make money through online advertising. There were over 100 fake news websites run by this group that published false and inflammatory pro-Donald Trump content. One headline that was popular or common was that Pope Francis endorsed Trump, or Hillary Clinton sold weapons to ISIS. Later on, these sites had to change up their tactics to avoid detection that they were fake news. So they copied content from existing conservative U.S. outlets. They targeted the outlets because the right-wing social media platforms were less likely to take down the false information. This is most likely because the content was pro-Trump anyway, so it benefited the news outlets too. That was kind of their perspective. Okay, so the ones in North Macedonia, were actual fake news websites. What Donald Trump did is he took the term fake news and turned it into an attack on legitimate media. He did what he does best. He twisted something to use for his own benefit. And what he tends to do is say the term over and over and over and over and over, and you kind of become desensitized to the attack so that it becomes common. And then other people, you know, really start believing it, even if it's not true. The first time that I could find that Trump used the term fake news was on December 10th, 2016, in a tweet attacking CNN. He just said, "Reports at CNN about me are false. Fake news," in big capital letters. So Trump tweeted that because he was upset that CNN wrote an article insinuating that he would still work part-time on The Apprentice if he became president, suggesting a conflict of interest. Of course, Trump took offense to that. And this is the first time in kind of a searchable record where he used the term to indicate that he would try to nullify any negative news about him. And I say searchable because sometimes his speeches and that sort of thing are harder to find sources for or are harder to search. Social media, though, you know, all on record forever. So during Trump's second term, what we're in now, he has made many moves to stifle media organizations that he deems liberal or ones that have criticized him. On May 1st, 2025, Trump signed an executive order that cut federal funding to NPR and PBS, called the Ending Taxpayer Subsidization of Biased Media. Not only did this direct the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or the CPB, to cut direct federal funding, it also directed the CPB to cut any indirect funding. So it was very thorough. CPB sued, but Republican-controlled Congress passed legislation in July 2025 that cut funding completely for NPR, PBS, and all of their member stations for fiscal year 2026 and 27, and that essentially nullified their lawsuit. So the CPB declared that it was shutting down operations as of August 2025. When the Associated Press, the AP, refused to change the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America in their publications, Trump barred AP reporters from certain press pool events on Air Force One and in the Oval Office. AP, of course, filed a lawsuit against the White House. Even more right-wing news organizations such as Fox News, Newsmax, and the Wall Street Journal signed petitions asking for the AP to be reinstated. On February 25th, 2025, the White House broke with the tradition of letting the White House Correspondents Association, or the WHCA, pick which outlets have access to the president, and decided to continue to exclude the AP while also making Bloomberg News and Reuters share a single seat for two wire services. Eventually, the White House just took out that slot that was reserved for independent wire services in the press pool, and they removed access for Bloomberg, Reuters, and the AP. Before this, the AP had covered the White House for 110 contiguous years. 19 presidents could handle the AP coverage. The 20th, President Donald Trump, cannot. In September 2025, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth required journalists to sign a pledge with restrictions for access to the Pentagon. The gist of the pledge was that they were not allowed to obtain or report unauthorized materials, even those that were unclassified. Essentially, they were to agree that they would only release the information that the Pentagon wanted to put out. The New York Times, AP, CNN, Reuters, and even right-wing outlets like Fox News and Newsmax, along with many other major media organizations, refused to sign the pledge, and their access to the Pentagon was revoked. I think the only one that signed it was OANN, which is already like a way extreme pro-Trump organization. So all the others said no. Here's the thing. If you're president of the United States, supposedly the most powerful man in the world, you are going to be criticized. The job of journalists is to report what is going on, especially what is going on with the government, and at times, critique our leaders. Having an independent press is part of having freedom. Let people know the facts and let them have the choice to decide what they think. I think a lot of people think that freedom of speech that is protected in the First Amendment just protects your personal rights, but it also protects and ensures an independent press. Here is what it says in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, 1791. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. An independent press specifically means that it is without the influence or the control of the government. It is part of the checks and balances of our government and in any free society. Journalists get the facts, but they also investigate. They have the freedom and the tenacity to investigate the different branches of government to keep corruption in check. If the media is only controlled by the government, then the public will only get the message the government wants them to hear. Do you remember the Iraqi Minister of Information during the 2003 invasion of Iraq and subsequent toppling of Saddam Hussein? American troops were rolling into Baghdad with barely any opposition. Yet this minister of information was releasing on Iraqi television that the Iraqi army was slaughtering U.S. troops. All the while, the Iraqi army had fled. That kind of propaganda is what would happen without an independent press. For today's episode, I spoke to Professor Barry Siegel, who is a Pulitzer-winning journalist, longtime national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, chair of the Literary Journalism Department at UC Irvine, and was one of my professors when I went to UC Irvine for a second bachelor's degree in literary journalism. We spoke about his career, how journalism has changed, and how vital an independent press is, especially when a government like Trump is leaning more toward authoritarianism than a democracy. So Barry Siegel is an American journalist and former national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2002 for his piece, A Father's Pain, A Judge's Duty, and A Justice Beyond Their Reach. He is also the chair of the UC Irvine's undergraduate degree program in literary journalism, of which I'm honored to be a graduate of. He is the director of the Center for Storytelling at UC Irvine as well, and is the author of 8 books, 5 nonfiction and 3 fiction. Honestly, I have always known you to be awesome, thoughtful, and a wonderful storyteller. So thanks again. Did I miss anything that you would like to add?
No, I think you got it all, Jerise. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, this is great. All right. So kind of starting out, we want to talk about freedom of speech and especially the role of journalists in the United States. What do you think is the main role of journalists in the United States?
Well, you should know, when I was first coming up in the field, we had a little mantra about this, that the role of the journalist was to, empower the powerless and oppress the powerful. and I think that that might be a good mantra to hang on to as a central thought. And I think that, but beyond that, because, yeah, That obviously is a pointed a goal, but I think, of course, we also just have a more general responsibility to keep the American public informed. This is critical in a democracy to just to keep everybody it's like a continuing education as we go through life, and so I like both of those, keep them informed, and then when we can, empower the powerless and oppress the powerful.
I love that. I know this podcast, originally my idea for it was to come up with lots of different topics, from politics and medicine and those sort of things. I did a one on Ouija boards and the science behind Ouija boards. But I find myself really trending toward politics right now with everything going on, because I feel like it is so important. And my friends were like, Darice, you got to do some lighter topics. And I said, these aren't light times, so it's hard to do that.
No, It's hard to turn away. As painful as it is sometimes to keep exposing ourselves, we have to stay aware.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be draining for sure. But
Oh man, it's.
my husband will come home sometimes and I've consumed the news almost all day. And he'll say, I want to watch the national news. I'm like, no, you don't. You don't. I'll just give you a summary.
I keep on telling myself I'm going to switch it all off because of how upsetting everything is, but I never do.
No.
I think I'm kind of addicted, but I think behind the or what's driving the addiction is a feeling or an impulse to always be aware.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, there's a term that has been used a lot in the past, let's say 10 years, fake news. When you hear the term fake news, do you think there is any truth to journalism or the media not checking facts? Or is it just a ploy to delegitimize the media?
Well, that to me, that's an easy question, Doris. It's a ploy. It most clearly is a ploy, but let's clarify this though, because I don't want to make it that simple. The term fake news is obviously a created term to delegitimize, but that does not mean that journalists always get everything right. It's unavoidable that you're going to make mistakes, particularly say on the newspaper level. You're moving fast and you're trying, you got deadlines and you've got a paper out. And even if you're working on more like a magazine article, the process of getting everything right is challenging, even if you are determined to do so. So what I resist about this term fake news is the notion that where somebody is purposely making things up and faking it. That's absolutely diametrically opposite of what we do. But at the same time, we have to recognize the imperfection of the people and the process. That is why newspapers carry a box every day called corrections. You're not gonna, there's very rarely will that box be empty, but the very fact that it exists, I think, is indicative of how much the journalists value accuracy. If they get it wrong, they don't want to duck it. They want to, the next day it's there's the correction.
Yeah,
So but
for
that's
sure.
not but that's not fake news.
Yeah,
That's
yeah.
not fake news.
Yeah, exactly. I know I've, right after I graduated from UC Irvine, I was writing longer pieces for like Gizmodo. I did a few about ketamine, how they use ketamine for treatment-resistant depression. But I had a big, long deadline, like 3, 4 months to work on the story. So I could really go in and make sure I got everything, very accurate. With this podcast, I'm trying to get out an episode every 2 weeks. And as a one man, one woman show, that is really hard, and also being a mom and a wife and having a life outside, So, yeah. So if I make mistakes, it bothers me, but I'm also like, wow, but this is a really, tough timeline.
Well, so here's one of the things that not just myself, but my colleagues, because we would talk about it at the LA Times in the many years I was a correspondent there. We would spend I mean, the kinds of pieces we did, we would spend months on them sometimes because we were in a group that was allowed to do these long form narratives. Okay, now it was we went through a whole multiple levels of copy editors, readers, fact checkers. It had to clear a lot of hurdles Copy editors were working more on your mistakes of grammar and the writing, but we also had fact checkers, particularly for the Sunday magazine. I had to hand over all my notes and let them call people and such like that. A lot of my colleagues resisted that because we didn't do it in the newspaper proper itself. It was just for the Sunday magazine because they used a lot of freelancers. My colleagues resisted that, and I actually welcomed it because I wanted to find out. Yeah, please do. Let's find out. But I can tell you something, and that is, I can't tell you how regularly we would, those of us who worked on these projects, would, in the days before they were about to be published, lay in bed at night, sleepless, staring at the ceiling, scrolling through our mind. Scrolling through our mind, trying to, what did we, that was always the fear that we had gotten something wrong. You know, we had already made the prose as pretty as we could make it and figured out our structure. But did you just get something wrong that is now going to appear on the front page of the LA Times with your byline on it? And I, that to us was a constant kind of attention. And the only way you could deal with it is to be very, is to scrutinize, scrutinize, scrutinize.
Yeah, it's true. I wrote this first article about ketamine for Gizmodo, and I always the people I interviewed, I always say, "Hey, here's the link, check it out." And I heard someone say, "Oh, don't do that because they're gonna, scrutinize your stuff and have problems with it or whatever." I'm like, "Yeah, that's okay. I wrote it the best I could." And so one guy, he was just such a scientific mind, and he took exception to just this teeny tiny little detail, wasn't necessarily asking for correction, but I still remember it. I still remember that he was like, "Well, but this was misleading," and I'm like, "Ooh, but was it?" And it really bothered me. And it still does, but I'm
And
also
that's,
like, yeah,
and Doris, there's a lot of pressure involved there because if I could divide, explain the sort of the kind of tug of war that's going on because we want to correct facts that facts that are wrong that are just wrong, but we also have our subjects will also just want it to. Express their viewpoint, and which is different than saying it's incorrect.
Right, very true.
And that's what you were just describing. You will have subjects you're never going to satisfy the all people write about, and they're all going to have their own narrative about themselves, and that is different from factual accuracy. And there's a point where we have to maintain control of the narrative because we're the ones who are telling the story. And so
That's true.
there's a built-in tension there.
That's true. It's hard, but I love it. So your career began around 1972 after you graduated from Columbia with your master's in journalism. How has journalism changed during your career? And then also, how has the perception of journalism changed, if it
Yeah,
has?
well, it's the sea change. It's just, I mean, it's not recognizable, the world I went into. And yes, you're right. My career began in 1972 when I graduated, but I actually was an intern at a couple at Portland Oregonian and the Washington Post even before that. So I've been hovering around newspapers since about 1970, I think. And well, I don't let the list goes on and on, but let's just first say the obvious fact is that when I began, there was a lot of newspapers and they were fat, thick, many pages because they had many ads in them, which, by the way, is how our work was financed. It wasn't the reader's 50 cents or whatever. It was all those advertising department stores and whatever buying ads. So it was an ad thick, pages thick newspaper world. A lot of papers and a lot of influence and power. And I timed it right. I left in that world and came to UC Irvine, and it's now been 22 years. And in that period, of course, we've all watched a real decline. And I don't mean necessarily in the spirit or the quality. I'm talking about the business model. The business model has gone off the rails, and the obvious answer is thank you, internet, which just has sucked away all those big advertisements. And in fact, it was before even the internet sucked away the big display ads. I'm not sure most people maybe even recall the pages and pages of classified ads that used to run in newspapers. Well, and nor do people realize that those classified ads provided about 40% of the advertising revenue that newspapers made. There's pages and pages of classified ads. So what blew that out of the water? Craigslist.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Craigslist blew out the classified ads, and then the internet, of course, just you could target your advertisers could start advertising more and more on the internet, and being able to target specific audiences rather than buy a costly big display ad in a general interest newspaper. So advertising revenue shrinks, the papers shrink and go out of business. So there's just a lot less, and it's a, and that part of it is a business model, just has gone off the rails. But I will say, in place of the newspaper, those newspapers, we have seen just an enormous explosion of other kinds of platforms for news, for storytelling. Obviously, on that very internet that carried the print, there's just so many different platforms. My students come in the LJ program. Yes, some of them go get jobs on the remaining newspapers, but they also find so many places, platforms on the internet where they can either get jobs or certainly place articles. So it's the environment has shifted. The other thing that I would say about the change, though, is that there used to be, and this is beyond the issue just of the shrinking business model, there used to be a shared narrative, whether or not, you know, people, of course, still disagree back in the day. You know, there was plenty of polarized thought, thinking, right wing, left wing, top, bottom, whatever. But we began that process all by watching the same news. First of all, there wasn't all these cable stations. You had the three main network news, evening news, NBC, ABC, CBS. Okay, and you just mainly, which one are you going to watch? Walter Cronkite, or or Peter Jennings, and so it just Huntley Brinkley. But you're basically, everybody was witnessing the same narrative, and then having different, you're still having different responses. The huge difference now is there is no central narrative in community journalism. We live in an environment now where there are just multiple narratives, depending on, and you depending on your bent, your inclination, will read or turn on that narrative or that narrative. So you have this incredible balkanization of what used to be a shared narrative. I think, this is beyond consequential, because we're not, the ability, we're not experiencing the same world.
It's very true. It's almost like you can think about, even if it's subconsciously, your own confirmation bias and find the exact media outlet that feeds into that, you know.
And you do, and then you, and that's where you stay.
And that's where you stay. Because it isn't, even as someone who tries to be balanced, I have a hard time going to media outlets that I don't like, you know, what they're saying. I don't like the narrative that they're telling. It is painful. I still try to do it, so I, you know, am informed, but it hurts. So it's more comfortable to go, you know, for someone just to go, I'm gonna just watch this and, you know, or listen to this. And it is kind of interesting too, how, like you're talking about, it used to be all newspapers, and I remember the classifieds. That's how I got my first job, in the classified ad. But now, you know, like even just what I'm doing, you know, I'm trying to focus a lot on YouTube, and for me to make a profit, I have to get subscribers, and to get subscribers, I have to fancy up my videos and my content, you know, in a way that keeps people's attention. And I don't want that to change what I'm producing, but I do find myself having to really like think about how things are put together so I can get subscribers. And it's really hard, you know. It's like such a flooded market.
And that is a major change. Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, at least you have these opportunities, you know.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's why when certain doors close, others open, and here you are, you know. And at least you can, and you do it. But you're absolutely right. It puts you in a position you want to be a leader of some thoughts and insights and such. But you also have to be a marketer. And this is a profound difference. I will be honest with you. In all my years, I was at the LA Times for 28 years. One of the things that, particularly in the era where I was working, it shields me from marketing because, and why? Well, because paper is real big, thick, has a lot, over 1 million readers, and that no one's going out from their house to go to the store or wherever or their driveway. Say, I want to buy Barry Siegel's latest long form narrative. They could be
I mean,
going
they
to get
should,
the paper.
but
They're a mistake, but they're going to, you know, maybe they're going to get the sports scores or the movie scenes. There used to be movie advertisement for movies in paper. You see that? All kinds of things, reasons why you might be picking up a newspaper. But then, lo and behold, on the front page, there's this long form narrative by one of us. And so we get read. But it wasn't that kind of necessarily conscious. Where I began to really encounter the marketplace, I've been so protected, was when I began writing books. Because
That's
that's
big.
obviously you can't just write a book. That book has to sell, and somebody does have to pick that book up and decide to pick up that book by me. Not you know, I got no sports scores or movie listings inside those covers. So that becomes, and not only do I have to be concerned with marketing, but in fact, to sell a book proposal to a publisher, they are not just simply making an editorial judgment like my newspaper editors would. I turn an article to them, all they're trying to decide is how well did he do it and has he got it right and is it important or whatever. The book publisher has to ask the question, will it sell?
That is a tough question to answer too, you know.
Yes. It's
I mean,
impossible to answer. It's
I know.
immediate. They don't know, but they have to act and choose anyway.
I know, when I'm picking my content, I have to go on to like Google Trends and see what people have been searching for. And I hate to cater to that, but sometimes you need to, it's just kind of how it is now, but just put my Doris spin on things, So you have traveled all over the world in your career. Is the role of the media in the United States unique compared to other countries? Or do you think, the experience is universal?
Well, I don't. I can tell you what I sort of get to have a sense of, but I want to correct that a little bit. I don't have that much expertise because I really haven't traveled all over the world my career. I was a roving national correspondent for the LA Times, so I think I've been in all 50 states over during those 28 years, or almost all. I don't think I got to Alaska and maybe one or two others, but I've traveled all over our country. And I have, for some stories, I've gotten down into South America and to the Pacific Islands, one time to London, but not, I'm not really in that way where I was that exposed to the role of journalism all through the world. But what I can say is that as long as we are a democracy, and of course that's up for question now, we inevitably have a stronger journalism than you could possibly have in a country that is joining a democracy.
Definitely.
And of course, that's what one of your themes here, Doris, is about freedom of the press and all of that. And of course, that's we're watching a lot of pressure
I
right
know.
here in our country that we that's another major change.
It is. It is. It's I kind of the question is, can you call yourself a democracy if you don't have a fully independent press? I mean, political leaders are never gonna love everything that you say about them, for sure. But like you were talking before, it's about educating the public on what's going on. And I don't know. I mean, do you think we can call ourselves a democracy if we don't have an independent press?
Yeah, no, I think no, we can't. I don't. I think that independent press is essential to a democracy. And in your question recalls to me very well-known, famous comments made by Thomas Jefferson many years ago when our country was just forming, in which he talked about the necessity of a free press for a democracy. Here's one of his quotes. I have it here for you. "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter."
Interesting. I love that.
Yeah. Necessity of a free press for democracy was a main theme he championed. Now, I just again, because I want to keep things complicated and not be simplistic here, and he said it was essential for a republic. He just believed free press was vital to keep citizens informed and acting as a check on on public authority. Absolutely. And he also saw the press as a watchdog. As in a sense, guarding against the abuse of power by public officials. However, and this is important, at the same time, he did not hesitate to criticize the press. And this is why it's let's not over. He says, it can that it can entire times misinform the public. He said sometimes was filled with things that were that just weren't true. Partisan biases. Well, he recognized the partisan nature of the press, and basically he hoped that the press would self-regulate by adhering to true facts and sound principles, but acknowledged the difficulty of achieving this. But that's what he wanted. So he was championing the freedom of the press, but saying self-regulate, self-regulate.
And that's difficult in today's environment when you have honestly such vast amount of different types of media and outlets. You know, you have more than just the cable stations. You've got the internet, which has everything possible, and you even just have citizen reporters. You know, one thing I've been kind of enjoying on TikTok recently is people who live in Portland who are like, wow, you know, look how dangerous our city is. I'm at the farmers market, which is kind of a silly thing, but it's also, you know, a political criticism of what's going on and you know, the truth according, you know, to them. So
Well, what's
it's
and
hard to
what's going
regulate.
on? And Degrees, what's going on? We should make clear it's not just a threat to journalism. You just said it's the citizens too. What's being attacked is not just freedom of the press, but freedom of speech. And that's pretty important to make that point, because this isn't just there is it's not just the working professional journalists are being targeted. It is a war on speech, free speech, the expression of an opinion. By any of us, whether it's coming in a formal newspaper article or, I mean, this current administration banned the Associated Press from certain press events because it didn't refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, as they were instructed to do. We had our beloved late night television personality almost lose his show because he had said something that they didn't like. It's he's calling the Trump right now is suing the New York Times for like $15 billion.
He sued him of them a few times, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's done tries it's always gets thrown out, but I
Well,
will
yeah. Which is good, you know, the courts are doing what they're supposed to do.
But above all, what's going on is this is a per, per, there's a persecution of people based on point of view, not what they've done, but just on the on point of view. And of course, this is pretty diametrically exactly what the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment prohibits. Here we go.
Here we go. I'm encouraged to hear that the LJ program is doing well, because I fear with the attacks on journalists, you know, his censorship and criticism on journalists and lawyers as well, that those fields are, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe when you're 22, you don't think about those things, but you know, that they're hopefully going to still flourish with good quality people, you know, because it's scary. It's a scary environment, you know.
They are my LJ majors are the future.
I love it. I love it. I really do. I've always been so grateful for my time at UC Irvine, despite the ridiculous commute for me. It was worth every second, every curse word I uttered while sitting in traffic.
That's good. That's
It was wonderful. All right, well, I got a couple more questions for you, and then I know you are limited on your time. So we're talking about that, about the media. Let's talk kind of political criticism. Do you think the media should be allowed to criticize the government without limits?
I don't know what those limits would be, and who's going to define the limits, who's going to impose and enforce the limits. So it's kind of I mean that it's actually scary. Though I should tell you, in earlier times, it wasn't you didn't have ex it was still two forces, the fourth estate again, but there would be at least some communication. And I don't know, if your listeners know this, but for instance, when the John Kennedy, President Kennedy administration, this is back in the early 1960s, was preparing to invade Cuba, the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the New York Times learned of it ahead of time. And they called in the president called in the editor in chief and publisher of the New York Times and talked about the relative the safety of their armed forces, if and the New York Times wasn't forced at that time. They agreed to hold back on a story, which in retrospect they questioned that because the Bay of Pigs was a disaster, and the invasion was a disaster. And you started thinking afterwards, well, we probably should have, what would happen if we had told that? More recently, the New York Times was editor was called in, not recently, but not that long ago, by President Bush, George Bush, second Bush, Bush two, and because they learned about the fact that the administration was essentially eavesdropping on telephone calls of people inside the United States, just anybody and everybody. Obviously, they were looking for certain things, but they were plugging into. And again, the New York Times had it, and again, the editor in chief was called in to meet with Bush, and but Bush it wasn't ordered or wasn't it, they couldn't they were no Bush argued for them, pled for them to not, and the New York Times decided to publish anyway in the case. Okay, that's how. So there been my point being that there was negotiations and talking about certain things when it might affect national security or lives of our armed forces, but just suggest that we're not be allowed to should media be allowed to criticize the government without limits? Short answer, yes.
Absolutely. And then you had the Atlantic editor accidentally included on the Signal chat with Pete Hegseth and all of that, and he decided not to. He waited, didn't he? Which was really interesting, honestly. And probably there were some discussions at the Atlantic about what to do there.
Well, I think that the point here is simply that it's we're not it's not the it's we're not irresponsible, and that it's I can just tell you that I know. I mean, it's momentous consequences sometimes, and that we're aware of that.
Absolutely.
That's why you middle of the night stare up at the ceiling. It's the consequences about these things, and nothing is done without due consideration, I think.
Absolutely. All right, so last question for you. We talked a little bit about this earlier about confirmation bias and how people really go to the media outlet that plays into that confirmation bias. Do you think it's possible to share balanced news and be successful in today's rather high-charged, divisive climate.
Oh, Teresa, I so wish I could say yes,
I
but
know, me
I
too.
so wish I did. I mean, I so wish. But the truth is I don't see how. I don't see how, and it has to do with it. Partially, just has to do with how polarized everybody is in the world, the deep polarization. But it also has to do with, again, back to business models and marketing and stuff. You've got these different platforms and publications and stations with a targeted audience rather than a general one. That's what, when you asked me much earlier in our conversation about what had changed, and that in the past, that was what it was, is that you were speaking to a broad general audience, or writing to. And so when I say polarization, it's not just a political polarization, it's an economic kind of breakdown. Fox News can't they'll lose their targeted audience if they don't do X, Y, and Z, and MSNBC is, and this, that, and the other thing. So, alas,
I
I
know.
wish, I wish, I wish,
I
and
know. I know. I started this podcast thinking I could be balanced, and I try to be, but try to represent all sides. But I have a perspective, and have things I want to say that, especially in today's climate, so it's hard to completely be, you can't be neutral, I guess,
well, Teresa, in your particular endeavor here with this podcast, you would not succeed if you were in a balance. You see, I mean, it's important. You need to have a perspective, a point of view, a voice. Otherwise, why are we tuning into your
What is this?
podcast? That's exactly the dynamic of it. What would be nice is if we all could at least go to our foundational information source, and then from there share our varying perspectives and responses. But I don't think it's your role in what you're doing to provide that, and it wouldn't work.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. Oh, well, I
So,
cannot thank you enough for this interview. And again, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
please do send me that link and stay in touch.
A body of men holding themselves accountable to nobody ought not to be trusted by anybody. Thomas Paine, The Rights of Man, 1791. Thomas Paine arrived in the United States from England in November 1774. He was destitute and sick with typhus, but immigrated from England after a chance meeting with Benjamin Franklin in London that same year. Imagine boarding a boat for weeks to a new country, excited, filled with hope, encouraged that an intellectual like Benjamin Franklin likes your revolutionary ideas. You land in this new world with a high fever, chills, violent shaking, headache, painful muscle aches and cramps, confusion, delirium, nausea, and vomiting. Though Paine was only minimally educated and from humble roots, he was a voracious learner and a bold, deep thinker. So bold and so deep that he impressed Benjamin Franklin, and Benjamin Franklin sponsored Paine to come over to the New World. Within a year while living in Philadelphia, Thomas Paine began writing for the Pennsylvania Magazine. He wrote essays on slavery, women's rights, and social justice, all very revolutionary ideas at the time. In January 1776, Thomas Paine published Common Sense, a 47-page pamphlet that very simply and very plainly argued for American independence from Britain. Of more worth is one honest man to society, and in that the sight of God, than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived. Common Sense sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Because of its popularity and its understandable language, colonists went from believing that independence from Britain was a fringe idea to an outright national demand. At the time, King George III was a ruthless authoritarian, and Britain had some of the strictest seditious libel laws, as in, you could not criticize the king. Common Sense was an open, powerful challenge to royal authority. By publishing it, Paine was putting himself directly in line to be imprisoned. Common Sense demonstrated that political speech must be free, no matter who it offends, and that it has a lot of power. He changed people's minds that taking on Britain was a foolish idea. Common Sense was mass distributed throughout the colonies. It was printed in newspapers, read aloud in taverns and town squares, and reprinted in countless editions of newspapers. What was special about it was that it was written in plain language for anyone to understand. You didn't have to be educated or be an aristocrat to understand what he was saying. The success of Common Sense demonstrated that a free press could bypass elites and the government to reach ordinary citizens. One of the biggest keys of Common Sense was that it became the political foundation of the First Amendment, even though the First Amendment was written decades later. Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Adams, and other founders saw how printed ideas could mobilize freedom, and they made sure to include that in our founding documents. If you agree that the media should be censored, controlled, or coerced, you are not a patriot. You can fly 100 flags in front of your house or hang them from the back of your pickup truck. Even if you served in the military like I did, you do not stand for democratic ideals. You stand for authoritarianism. You might as well fly 100 Chinese flags because that is the type of government that you are supporting. The media has a responsibility too. Journalists must present the facts and must find those facts from reputable sources. I do not think it is possible to be completely unbiased because we are human, but things must be factual. Our leaders need to have thick skin to endure criticism from an independent press, but that is what it is like to lead a supposed democratic republic. It is critical that we hold our leaders accountable and, like Thomas Paine lived and breathed, that information gets to everyone, not just the elites of the country. Trump might consider journalists and the media as the enemy of the people, but really, the media is the only reason he ever became relevant. And he is a master at manipulating all kinds of media outlets, especially social media, to get his message out. Now that more media outlets are criticizing him, though, he is scared. He has to always be controlling the message. And the message, government shutdowns, mass firings, attacks on education, attacks on immigrants, inflation, high employment rate, all of these things are what he doesn't want people to know. Many people no longer support his messages. I love this quote from Thomas Paine, and it is applicable to today. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. So, what do you think? Are things right in this country? Thank you for listening to the Journalism of Everything podcast. I am a journalist and host, Doree Smith. Please watch and subscribe on my YouTube channel because that is the fastest way that I can get paid. I am also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Substack, and pretty much anywhere podcasts can be found. Thanks.